get started, I have to make a confessional here. It was a bad move on my part. I thought, well, I'd inject some novelty, into this by using a format for trying to get some stuff out, which I've not used before. But I thought, oh, this would be cutesy, be nice way of getting this stuff out. But the point is, I'm not used to really using this format. And so I said, well, I better get this stuff down like on a piece of paper so I don't get me lost, because I'm not used to going down these channels, So I wrote this thing out. And then what I found out this morning as I was looking at this, that I don't really have this thing nailed down, and what I mean by that is that I'm not as free of this piece of paper up here as I really wanted. I'm pretty free, but I'm still moderately a slave to it here. So if you see me, looking down every once in a while, cheating, it's because I haven't got this worked out. I'm not in rehearsal. That I was sort of reminded about that at least I'm not going to sit and read at you, for 50 minutes. You probably heard that old story about the preacher in a church who used to preach always from a full manuscript, not just notes, but a full manuscript. And he'd get up in the pulpit and he'd start and says, "Good morning," and then his head would go down and he'd read like for 25. Never, his head would never come up, no eye contact. Have you heard this one?
No.
This is tough to sit through. I mean, like 25 minutes of this, people are off catching Z's and everything, And it's sort of a way of making a statement of, like, maybe you should change your ways. There was a conspiracy among some of the deacons, and they said, we're gonna teach him a lesson, because the habit was always to go and put the manuscript. He always did this before the service started, set it right on the pulpit. So while he was off in the sacristy, or somebody went up and picked just a page right on the manuscript, just took it on. The sermon happened to be on Genesis. And so he's reading along. It's about on page 3 or 4 here. It says, and Adam said to Eve, and he turns the page, and he sees something's sort of wrong here. And Adam said to Eve, and Adam said to Eve, there seems to be a leaf missing. Well, I won't read at you. Suppose someone were just to ask you out of the blue, just cold turkey, don't you think we need a new ethic for dealing with a natural environment, a new environmental ethic? And, kind of befuddled, you might say, well, I don't know, is there something wrong with the old one? But, yeah, right. And so that, then the next thing, what I'm insisting is that reply not make any sense to you, because you might not have a clue as to what you just referred to as the current or old environmental ethic. And your problem may run deeper because you haven't got a clue as to what's an environmental ethic and what's an ethic, But there's been, for at least the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a group of conservationists, environmental philosophers, that have announced publicly that we need something which they call a new environmental ethic. And they devoted considerable effort to try and develop what, in their view, is a new improved version of an ethic to deal with our natural environment. And we're going to see some of these tacks to achieve that this morning. And what I hope we can achieve, before the hour is out, is some assessment as to how promising some of these new tacks really are. But let me try and defuzz some of those quirky questions which occurred at the outset. What's an ethic? How about this, just for starters? An ethic, let's simply take as a rule or maybe a set of rules which places limits on our acting as we please. And this rule or set of rules is going to be the criteria for judging whether what we do is morally right or wrong. Now, by extension, an environmental ethic, whatever this means, minimally, it's going to be a rule or set of rules which places constraints on our behaving as we please with respect to the organisms and objects in the natural environment. And it would be, whatever these rule or rules are, criteria for determining right and wrong behavior vis-a-vis the organisms and objects of the natural world. The first thing we need to ask, what is it that might be called the current environmental ethic? Or the old one? The ethic maligned, you know, by the new thinkers who think that's got to be trashed and we got to go for a new and better one. I mean, what is that? That old ethic, the current one, the reigning one that's supposed to be displaced. We'll get to that in a minute, but let me explain the procedure here. What I want to do is, and this is this new method, what I want to do is expose you to four fictional people, okay? And each of these people is going to represent a point of view. They'll have a name. And the first speaker will represent the point of view which is being dumped on by the others. Okay, this speaker is going to represent what you might call the current environmental ethic, the one that's wrongheaded from the standpoint of the critics. And then the other three will represent these various new tacks toward developing an allegedly more adequate environmental ethic. And what I have to fess up at the outset is that the arguments I'm going to put in the mouths of each of these other people are going to be overdrawn in the sense that they're going to omit a lot of qualifications that real-world defenders of these views actually make. But the end in view here is so you can capture the basic thrust of these supposed alternative ethical routes, so you can see how they really are different from each other. I mean, if we can achieve that, that's already a game. Who are the persona? Well, the first person you're going to meet, his name is Hugh Mann. Now, Hugh Mann is a defender of this position now, which is being maligned by the others. The one that needs to be changed, and bluntly put, Hugh represents this point of view. He's saying that any action that we do with respect to the natural environment should be properly assessed according to this rule. Now listen, does this action we're proposing with respect to the natural environment better than any alternative promise to maximize human welfare over the long haul of humans? Got it? The next party you're going to meet, her name is Anne Moll. Now, her friends call her Annie. And Annie Moll represents one certain leg of what's called the animal liberation point of view, the particular view trotted out by Tom Reagan at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, called the animal rights view. Then we got a young man, probably born in Hong Kong, a combination of British and Chinese extraction. His name is Livingston Ng. Now, his friends call him Liv, and Living represents this point of view that all living things, not just plants and animals, have rights. All. Lastly, we meet a guy, his name is Eco. I doesn't have a last name, sort of like Madonna. I don't even know what her last name is. But Eco represents a point of view in this debate which tracks very closely to another venue onto establishing a new environmental ethic, very close to the point of view of a great forester, conservationist from my home state of Wisconsin, whose name is Aldo Leopold. Leopold gave the elemental beginnings of this new environmental ethic some 40 or more years ago in a little essay called The Land Ethic. It's the very last essay in a wonderful group of essays collectively called the Sand County Almanac. So that's our rogues gallery. So let's start with Hugh Mann. Well, I believe that humans are the premier species on the planet. And I want to convince you that this is not just mindless favoritism. This is not pure prejudice, but I want to give you some reasons as to why we are the king of the hill. Because we've got going for us as humans a set of characteristics which no other organism on the face of this planet has. Let me tell you. But what do we have going for us that nothing else has got? Number one, we alone, among the creatures of the earth, can understand ourselves historically and theoretically. Look, every other creature is a product of the evolutionary process, but not one of those, say humans, understands that fact. We can understand ourselves in terms of evolutionary theory. All organisms play functional roles in various ecosystems, but they haven't got a clue that they do. We can understand how ecosystems operate and what those functions are. We're all physical organisms, chemical organisms, but only humans can understand themselves chemically, physically, from the standpoint of physical science, economics. Now look at this. The second thing we've got going for us that nothing else has got is that we alone are capable of generating works of art, music, literature, sculpture. Nobody else does that. And my piece de resistance argument in favor of the premier status of the human species is that we alone have the capacity for moral autonomy. That's a mouthful, but let me tell you what that is. The capacity for moral autonomy. I mean this. Not even the great apes, Coco and Lena, you know, that make the cover of National Geographic, you know, gorillas that carry on sign language interaction and plunk away at these pictogram typewriters down at the Yerkes Primate Lab down there. I mean, they're smart. But we still went up because we alone have the capacity to do this. We alone have the capacity to make our own behavior, to take a grandstander spectator point of view on our own behavior, stand back and ask this question. Is what I'm proposing to do right? Listen to that question. We alone can ask the ethical question. Now, how is it that we go about judging whether an action we're proposing to do is morally right or wrong? By virtue of a set of moral rules. And this capacity for moral autonomy is even more impressive because we have a further capacity to stand back more steps and take a grandstander point of view on the very rules that we use to appraise our behavior and ask, are these rules rationally defensible, all things considered? Ooh. I mean, I'm telling you. I mean, if I were to argue for the premierness of our species, I could just lay it on that. I mean, we are different. And I want to say that we're not only different, but we're morally superior to every other species. Now, what kind of mileage do I want to get from this? Well, I'm telling you that if you accept this, I've just given you arguments for this claim, I'm now asserting that the reason for being of all other species, all other non-human things in the world, the reason they're here is to serve human wants and needs. In other words, the value of any individual natural organism, an individual plant or animal, or a large-scale object like a river, beech maple forest, its value consists in its actual or potential value in maintaining and advancing human welfare. Now, I know there are a bunch of zanies out there in the environmental movement. They keep saying, oh, you know, but snakes have inherent value. Remember John Muir used to go out and the founder of the Sierra Club used to go out back in the 40s and stand as a one-person conscientious objector picket line against, you know, these people are going out for weekend rattlesnake shoots. I mean, that, you know, we got bass fishing contests and so forth. There's that rattlesnake shoot, you know, and turn people loose with their six guns over the weekend. There'd be prizes for the biggest snake you've wasted or how many snakes or whatever it is. And Muir used to go out and stand out and glare at all these people. And finally somebody came up to Muir and said, well, what good are rattlesnakes anyway? And Muir's famous reply is, well, they're good for themselves. Well, I'm telling you folks, a lot of people think that's profound. I just think it's obscure, and I think there's some distinction there. I don't know what, I mean, a lot of these people keep saying, well, these things have value in their own right. Inherent value in themselves. Well, what does that mean? I mean, do they have value if nobody valued them? I mean, value is a conferred status. No value, where are no values? I think they're sniffing glue. I mean, I don't understand all that stuff. It's just weird. But in order to head off at the pass, I know an objection is going to come, you know, from my critics, but I want to preempt it. What you're likely to hear from them is that they're going to say, you know, well, that man-centered ethic of yours, Hugh, what this is going to lead to is just the vast destruction of all the flora and fauna on the earth. I say, bore. We're not going to go around. I mean, man-centered ethic, why does that entail the destruction, the radical destruction of the world? We're not going to do that. You've got to distinguish between enlightened, savvy, human-centered people and dodo ones. Now, I mean, we're not going to go ravage the earth because we've got very good evidence if we do that it's going to have negative boomerang effects on us. I mean, it's not going to happen. But, what my ethic differs from, and you're going to meet this in some of the people down the road here, is that I'm not one of these kind of people that thinks that we've just got to preserve every single species which exists and make sure that none of them bite the dust. Why? Well, it's trade-offs, guys. I mean, if we would want to advance human welfare, regrettably, sometimes some species are going to have to kiss off. I mean, if we want to put a golf course there in the tide marsh and the Carmen blue butterfly, it's the only existing habitat that has to bite the dust, well, it's a trade-off. Now, we're not going to be crazy. What I mean by an enlightened humanist is one that does his or her homework before they make environmental interventions, and if they understand that some species is liable to be done in, the little snail darter down the Tennessee River or something, they're going to ask this question. Okay, suppose this thing exits, that it is no more. What are going to be the consequences on human welfare of its exiting? And it's simply false that ecosystems are like houses of cards. You know, one species goes, and the whole thing falls down. That's crazy. I mean, that's a weird point of view. It's not true. It's like a web. Break one string of web, hoping it doesn't fall down. I mean, so we have to be careful about what species we eliminate in the advancing human welfare. Just don't do the ones that are going to do us dirt. I mean, you eliminate a bunch of pollinating wasps in a rainforest, you're in trouble. You know, but geez, you got a group of little trillium that exists in a beech maple forest. If you pull the plug on the trillium, is the whole thing going to collapse? Well, I don't think so. You pull up all the beech maples, that's different. Okay, that's going to redound. Okay, so we have to be selective. But I'm human welfare first. We keep around what is useful to us, and if we have to let go, regrettably, you know, some stuff in the advancing human welfare, I say so be it. I've spoken my piece. Okay, here comes Annie Mall.
Don't you want to know if any of us want to follow that person?
Are there any people who represent their point of view?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness. Charles Krauthammer, who writes for the Time magazine. represents his point of view. A whole book was written defending his point of view by a guy named William Baxter called People Are Penguins, The Case for Optimal Pollution. I mean, I'm stealing the material right out of Bill Baxter. I mean, this is exactly the point of view. Let's go to Annie. She's talking to Hugh. She says, Hugh, you know, you seem to find mysterious this notion which you claim some people have that certain non-human animals have inherent value or value in themselves or value in your own right. Well, let me see if I can demystify this for you, Hugh. What I mean when I say that an individual animal has inherent value is this. It values its own life unconditionally. Want to hear it? It has inherent value because, and just so far as, it values its own life unconditionally. Let me see if I can get some mileage out of this. Let's start with you, Hugh. Now, surely you consider your total value to exceed your value to others, right? I mean, no doubt you hope to be useful to others, to your family, society. But don't you believe that even if you're of no use to others, that your life still has value? Do you believe that? A value which is independent of your usefulness to others? I mean, don't you value your own life as an experiencer of things? Don't you value the freedom, the task of pursuing activities aimed at maintaining and increasing the number of satisfying experiences you have? And because you place this kind of value on your own life, isn't that why you regard the taking of your life by somebody else as a very grave harm? After all, when your biological life is terminated, that ends your experiencing. It ends your pursuit of projects aimed at maintaining or improving your own quality of life. And isn't that why, because you value your own life, why you regard the infliction of pain on you as a harm? Isn't that why that when people restrain your freedom, you regard that as a wrong? I'm just asking where we get rightness and wrongness here, why you consider these things to be right or wrong. Because you value your own life. It matters to you what its quality is. So anybody who, without your consent, kills you, inflicts pain on you, inhibits your freedom, in order to advance their interests, is simply using you as a pawn. That person is relating to you as if your value is exhausted in your value to others. And you don't believe that. And the plot begins to thicken or sicken. I mean, listen to this language. Is it because you value your own life that that's how you come up with this language? I have a right not to be killed. I have a right not to be subjected to pain. I have a right not to have my freedom. I mean, listen, isn't that where that explosive language comes from? Because of the unconditional value that you place on your own life, your inherent value? Well, let's cut to the chase. Isn't there excellent reason to believe that many animals, particularly mammalian invertebrates, value unqualifiedly their own lives just like you do? I mean, look how they flee threats, how they pursue activities aimed at providing pleasurable rather than painful experiences. Look. And they don't value their lives less than you do, Hugh. So you and they have equal inherent value on the definition of that term that I'm using. In that very highly significant respect, humans and many vertebrate animals have equal inherent value. Now, one more step, And if you're a good poker player, you can turn the cards, see where it's going. A fundamental principle of ethics is that equals must be treated equally. Now, if we and these mammalian vertebrae animals have equal inherent value in the sense just articulated, and if we ground our alleged rights not to be killed, rights not to be subjected to pain, rights not to have our freedom limited, on the ground of our inherent value, you get the message? The same argument can be launched for speaking of the right to life, the right to freedom, and the right to be free from pain on behalf of animals. We're starting to place constraints now on our treatment of animals. Let's face it, Hugh, seems to me that on the theory you subscribe to, where everything is humans, 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 you're going to be really hard-pressed to account for why it would be wrong for you, for example, to go and, let's say, what, painlessly kill a zebra to satisfy some trivial interest of yours, like making an interesting steering wheel cover out of its hide for your car. I mean, why would that be wrong? Let's face it, Hugh. Your enlightened, humanistic environmental ethic is just plain human chauvinist. Name calling number one. Okay, to live. He's talking to Annie. Oh, Annie, Jesus. Are you aware that in your view, you know, this view which accords inherent value only to feeling conscious creatures. Are you aware that your view implies that all the world's plants have value simply as resources for satisfying the needs and desires of either humans or our equal animal cohorts? In my view, Annie, you have an unjustified prejudice toward the welfare of conscious beings. I think you're a vertebrate chauvinist. Name calling number two. I maintain that all living things have inherent value, including plants. The value of plants is not, of individual plants, is not exhausted in their value as food, cover, building materials for human or non-human animals, any more than, in your view, Annie, the value of non-human animals is exhausted in their welfare for advancing the welfare of humans. I think you're really myopic. Now, how is it that an individual plant has inherent value? I know we got puzzles. Hugh's going to feel like he's sniffing glue right now. I mean, because now we're really getting out. Well, I'll tell you, an individual plant doesn't have inherent value because it's conscious and values its own life. I mean, that's how Annie gets inherent value going for the animals. Plants aren't conscious. Remember the guy, Cleve Baxter, used to show up on Johnny Carson? And he was the guy that claimed plants had feelings. Did you ever see one of these 20 years ago? Where there was a plant sitting on Johnny's table, and Johnny said, in a minute, we're going to have this guy, Cleve Baxter, come out, and we're going to have a camera trained on this plant, and it was like a galvanometer or something, measured electrical potential in the leaves and so forth. And then Johnny informed us that just before the show, Cleve Baxter had taken a cigarette lighter to one of the leaves of this plant. Okay? All right. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Cleve Baxter, and here comes the curtain, and the camera homes in us in a galvanometer, or is it just going like this? Like, see, plants have feelings. I mean, I don't hold this view. I don't believe that plants are conscious, says Liv. But I still believe that it's possible to insist that plants have inherent value, but in a different sense. And here's the sense. You have to follow. It's a little tricky. But I say that plants have inherent value so far as plants, like every living organism, have a good of their own. a good of their own whose criteria can be objectively specified. A good of their own. Now what do I mean by this? Let's just take plants. When I say they have a good of their own, I mean for any plant. And this holds for any living thing. It's possible to specify the criteria for faring well, flourishing, as the kind of plant it is. You can do that for insects. You can distinguish between a flourishing boll weevil and a languishing one. You can distinguish between flourishing Australian milfoil and languishing, right? And I'll tell you why I think that's true, because my wife's a gardener, and I don't know how many times I trot down to the local hardware store to that huge ortho encyclopedia of plant sicknesses to find out why the funny leaves, you know, what ortho product do I need to deal with the stippled leaves on a tree? Okay, now, plant botanists can distinguish between rhododendra that are faring well and faring ill, right? I mean, now I'm not the least bit interested in poison ivy. I hate it. But a botanist can distinguish between a flourishing poison ivy plant and a languishing one. Now, that's important because the state of flourishing, listen to that word, flourishing, that's a value term. It's a good state of affairs for that kind of entity. And if something's good, automatically the boat is tipped on the presumption as to why, how would you justify doing anything which either eliminates or jeopardizes that good in the world? Now look, mosquitoes. I mean, I can distinguish between a languishing mosquito, or I mean, an entomologist can do this. Now, notice how whether I value the mosquitoes or the poison ivy is a non-issue here. The question is there an objective state of flourishing or faring well as that entity whose criteria can be objectively specified? And the answer is yes. And a state of flourishing for that entity is a good thing in the world, and if something's good, you need to start talking if you're going to do anything to jeopardize it. Now, I'm getting more in the pot of things whose welfare we have to care about than Annie or certainly Hugh has. Now, I know Annie and Hugh might come back and somebody say, yeah, but the problem, Liv, is there's a big difference between plants and humans and animals, namely that what happens to humans and animals matters. It matters to them because they're conscious. But plants aren't conscious. I mean, what happens to them doesn't matter to them. Therefore, they haven't got any interest because they aren't interested in faring well. Well, my response to that would be, I just don't think you understand the English language. In English, we can distinguish between two senses of interest. I can say, John is interested in smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. I can also say, it's not in John's interest in smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. Now listen to that difference. Now what I mean by the first is that John desires to smoke two packs a day. That requires consciousness, okay? The latter means that smoking two packs is not conducive to his faring well as a human being. That's a sense of interest, isn't it? Can we ever do anything that's not in the interests of plants? That is something that can be antithetical to their faring well as plants? God, just go out to Ted's country, you know? Got all these national forests and so forth out there in California surrounded by freeways, and then the photochemical smog drifts over and the ponderosa and Jeffrey pine trees are going like this from the ozone. Are we doing something antithetical to the interests of the plants? Are the ponderosa and Jeffrey pine trees interested? No. But we're doing something which is not conducive to their good, their faring well, the kind of entity they are. So I maintain that an adequate environmental ethic is going to have to be one
which recognizes the inherent value of every living thing, and it's going to call for the protection and the preservation of all living things, and not just a limited set, humans and animals. Eco, he's talking to Hugh. Hugh, you know, you're an educated person. I know you're familiar with evolutionary theory, the principles of ecology. And it seems to me that this human-centered orientation that you're plumping for, your view that the reason for being of all Earth's creatures outside of the human gambit, the reason for their being here is to advance human welfare, is simply belied by what you know in the bottom of your heart from evolutionary and ecological theory. I mean, evolutionary theory reveals that all the denizens of this planet evolved into their myriad contemporary forms from a single-celled common ancestor. I mean, all Earth's organisms are literally, not metaphorically, but literally kin, members of one huge extended family. And from the standpoint of ecological theory, with which you're familiar, Hugh, each species has the physical features it has and the behavioral repertoire it has because it co-evolved with other species. Its physical characteristics, its behavioral pattern, is the result of a mutation odyssey that was at every point subjected to environmental pressures. And these pressures then selected for certain genetically based traits that permitted it to successfully compete for limited resources and reproduce itself. Humans, plants, and animals acquired the specific characteristics through interactive adaptation to other organisms. Let me hear it again. Whether it's humans, plants, or animals, every species acquired the specific characteristics it has through interactive adaptation to other organisms. Each is what it is because of its relationships to others. So from the standpoint of evolutionary theory, Homo sapiens is one uno species among many produced from a single-celled common ancestor. From the standpoint of ecological theory, the human species is but one member of an interlinked biotic community, a life support web that has many competing but also mutually adaptive and supportive relationships engaged in the common task of life support. The human species is only one member of the biotic team, no more. Now, Hugh, look, here's the point. It's this matrix, this whole interacting community, which community is really a solar energy circuit, that's the very fountain of life. So it's the well-functioning of the entire interdependent system that's important. The system without which we and every species would neither be nor be specifically the way we are. So here, from the standpoint of evolutionary and ecological theory, the proper rallying cry is not human welfare first, but the welfare of the entire biological community first. Evolutionary and ecological theory hardly suggests the fundamental principle of environmental ethics should be the one you endorse, Hugh, namely, always pick that option that will produce the greatest good of the greatest number of humans over time. Uh-huh. An adequate environmental ethic grounded, I hope, in sane evolutionary and ecological theory will be based on this principle. Now hear this. Always act so as to preserve the beauty, the integrity, and the stability of the entire biotic community. This is holistic. Hugh, he's been listening to all this, and like the biblical Mary, pondering these things in his heart. He responds, first of all, to Annie. Annie, your position accords equal inherent value to all animals, human and non-human, that are experiencing beings and that value their, your own lives. That's the deck you're dealing from. Now you argue that these animals then have, among other rights, an equal right, flawless humans, not to be killed by us. So, in your view, those Japanese fishermen who slaughtered dolphins because the dolphins were thought to be depleting the local fish population were acting just as wrongly as if they had slaughtered an equal number of their human neighbors for the same reason. I find that a ridiculous implication of that position. Hugh speaks to Liv. You know, your position accords every living thing an equal right to life and a right not to be inhibited in pursuing its DNA goal of being a flourishing example of its type. But this view foists responsibilities on humans which are extraordinarily onerous, if not impossible, to fulfill. I mean, if we take seriously your view, we can only live in plastic or concrete houses, not wood, and they should be very small. Can't own any books. We can eat only vegetable foods that don't involve the killing of any plant. I mean, what is our diet supposed to be? Dead and rotting fruit, addled eggs? I mean, the implications of your position are about as wacko as the implications of Annie's. To echo, eco. Hugh says, well, you call attention to the fact that from the standpoint of ecology, the human species is simply one member of the planet's biotic team. No more. Now, seen through the glasses of ecological theory, the human species is demoted to the status of simply being one member of a living community of organisms, which community functions as a solar energy circuit. You then elevate to the status of the most morally important entity in the universe, the entity whose good is paramount to all others, the entire interacting system of biological species. You then come up with your moral rule. Either it's the only moral rule that we're to live by, or the primo rule among rules, that focuses solely on the welfare of biotic systems, preserving the beauty, the integrity, stability of the entire ecosystem, or the system of all systems, the ecosphere, is job one. Any other moral obligations we may think we have are trumped by that one. But that's also an absurd view. I mean, on your approach, if we faced a choice to either kill a rare wildflower or a plentiful human being, if the wildflower as a team member, you know, would contribute more to the integrity, the beauty, and stability of the biotic community than the human, then presumably we would not be doing wrong if we killed the human and saved the wildflower. I mean, expanding on this point, if I read the current ecological and environmental literature correctly, it seems that these people are in agreement that from the standpoint of the integrity, diversity, and stability of the worldwide biotic community, there are just too many people around and an ever-decreasing number of other species. So it follows on your point of view and from your ethical principle that we should eliminate 90% of human beings for the sake of the welfare of the ecosphere. Frankly, I'm not true. Frankly, I think your view amounts to environmental fascism. Name-calling number four. In my view, an enlightened, not a dodo, but an enlightened, human-centered approach to environmental ethics is the most reasonable choice. I rest my case. Well, that's the end of the quadrilogue, or whatever it is. Is there a winner? Does Hugh win out?
I hope not.
I think the winner is in the discussion, in the conversation. And these are all points, weird as they may seem to some people, they're all points.
But when you hear the arguments unfold, as the argument goes, they all trade
on considerations which one you hear, and says, well, that's plausible. Mm-hmm. Seems to me that that works. And then you get the zinger at the end, and you're very unhappy. But it seems to all the reasons, and then you seem to be committed to the conclusion.
But there are even more reasons. We need the plants because of what they give off to over the carbon dioxide, cleaning up our, I mean, there was more to it than what you were saying.
Yeah, but you would simply say, well, that's why we would never, if we're enlightened, go around just ripping off the floor of the earth. But that, he's not committed to just saving furbish louse warts or something. I mean, if they don't have any, I mean, if we got to do them in order to have, you know, a strip mall or something, that's okay.
As far as
but that's going to offend people like Liv and Eco.
Yes.
I mean, say it's going to offend that point of view. Why? Well, because, like John Muir said, they have value in their own right. Oh, well, in what sense? And that's what all this thing trades on.
Okay, what about the argument that at some point in time we might find value for them, but if they're not value to the human species, but if they're not around now, we will never be able to find that value.
Okay, that's a, okay, now here's an argument. Don't let any species go, because even though right now we've not got a clue as to what economic value it may have to us, it may have economic value in the future. Now you really start running this argument pretty well, because you can start giving examples of times we've come close to eliminating something that, oh boy, are we glad we saved that sucker. I mean, a few years ago in Mexico, they found some strain of maize, I guess they call it teosinte or something, and it's a corn, which is a perennial. I mean, dynamite. You don't have to replant it every year and so forth. Almost lost that sucker. And we found, you know, certain values in, what's the, where do we get taxol from?
Trees. Oh, eucalyptus.
Yeah, right. See, we didn't know that. So you're going to start saying, see? What? Don't let anything go, because you never know. Of course, the proper answer is that, well, yeah, you can say, you shouldn't let anything go, because it might have a resource or economic value someday. But then why can't somebody say, but then again, it might not? I mean, is that a crazy answer? But then again, it might not. And that latter answer gains increasing credence when you realize that the problem is more complex. We're not just talking about eliminating species, but there's all kind of subspecies. And now the question is every subspecies as important as every other? Ted and I were talking the other day. Remember the Tellico Dam fiasco down in the Little Tennessee River, where they had this dam built on a Little Tennessee River down near Nashville, and it was 90% complete, and we'd already passed, this is in the 70s, 71, 72, and they already passed the Endangered Species Act in 1964. Of course, all the senators and reps thought they were protecting bald eagles and, you know, everything, you know, with this, and now the logic of this act comes home to them, because some fish study or something down at the University of Tennessee comes up and says, ah, there lives in the Little Tennessee River, right there by the dam, is the only habitat of the species of a perch, remember, called snail darter, three inches long. And he said, if you continue to build a dam, the snail darter is going to be done in. And the Endangered Species Act has spoken. It says that if there's any federal project which is going to endanger the critical habitat of a species that appears on the list, it either doesn't get off the drawing board or has to stop. So we got to take down the Tellico Dam. This is like $110 million? Well, holy smoly. Are we going to do this to save a snail darter? And the interesting thing is here, it says, well, who cares about the snail darter? Does it perform some great ecological function? The point is, if some species has gotten to the point where it's tottering on the brink of extinction, it's probably not performing a very fundamental function in the ecosystem. I mean, that's just a fact. And besides that, the snail darter was one of 431 species of darter, distinguishable only by ichthyologists and mother darters. And so the question, why is this, like, who cares? I mean, I can just see Hugh bringing the riot act to this. See?
But you made two points. The second one I think is true, the first one I don't. The second point was the subspecies and, you know, only ichthyologists can tell the point, so it's not an important niche.
Well, keystone species are different. I mean, those are real players.
Okay, but the first point was, if it's tolerated on the edge of extinction, therefore, by definition, it's not really a very important part of the ecosystem. And I think the fact that the dodos went out over the sensible people with Hugh's perspective have put species that have vital places in the ecosystem on an endangered list. So you can't say because they're tottering they have no value. Well, they used to have a great value,
like,
so we got rid of them.
Like the buffalo, you know. I mean, it wasn't the buffalo's fault they were tottering, it was the human's fault they were tottering. Is that what you're sort of saying?
Yeah, that's a good example.
I thought we were addressing the question as to whether, even though we concede that we are the planetary bully and their diminished populations and jeopardized habitat are doing, the question is, well, do we need to save them? And he would simply say, well, we got to do our homework and do an environmental impact statement and find out if we humans are going to lose big or significantly if they're done in. I mean, if their demise is necessary in order to achieve some human project, then we got to do the trade-off. I mean,
well, but you can't. What I was saying was, you said the darter snail doesn't have very good eco niche, so therefore, by definition, isn't very valuable because they'd be all over the world if they had an important niche. Well, the buffalo was all over the country at one point, and then they're down to nothing. I mean, that's a good example. So I don't think it's a very good argument for that they have value or not.
The sea otters would be another example. The sea otters were almost down to nothing because of the fur. They were killed through the fur.
And the other thing is, you know, that...
But why should we preserve them?
Well, I like sea otters.
Because of their inherent value.
No,
that doesn't give them inherent value. No, that's really important. Here's another reason upon which it's very hard to give a dollar sign value. Mm-hmm. Why should we preserve sea otters? Is because I like to see them. But that's a human conferred value. Okay, it doesn't say that they have value in their own right. If we just found something exceedingly ugly, some undersea creature or condors or kind of uggles or something, then they would lack value because humans didn't value them.
The abalone fishermen don't like sea otters.
The confusion here is in two different, very different questions. The one we are discussing basically in all four of these positions is what's wise.
And is why, what?
What is wise, advisable?
Wise.
What is? What would be the better decision in these things?
Wise for
us to decide what to do. That's right.
For him.
The other question is who gets to decide?
And it's humans.
It's humans. The error in the first argument is that there is such a thing as good or evil, right or wrong, before it is determined. You get there by this process. We started out by saying this is a discussion about ethics. Ethics is a decision about values. Values do not exist independently.
Of humans. We're the creator.
So that's right. And we decide what is valuable. And then when we've decided that, that which reinforces that value is good.
Right. There are no, nature doesn't come with any values.
That's right. There is no such thing as the right of a snail darter to live.
No.
Because rights language is our invention.
That's correct. There is nothing that is valuable until something gives it value, and none of the subspecies are capable of doing that. That's demonstrated by the fact that they can't do it if we don't want them to.
Well, no way. Do you think it's crazy to talk about a moose valuing its own life?
Sure.
Why? Because linguistically it can't bring it in speech?
No, it's the first step each of you took when you started introducing this topic to us. What is ethical? Ethical is that which reinforces the value. The value is something that we decided. Therefore, there can be mistakes and judgments, and we can blow it as we do routinely. But you cannot say that a right exists independently of a duty.
Oh, yes, you can.
No.
No, no, no. No, wait, wait. As an attorney, you know better. Well, no, wait. Are you saying that you can't intelligibly assign something rights unless this thing is capable of exercising duties?
No.
Well, I hope not, because there are a lot of incompetent things that are represented by attorneys who've got rights. They've got rights, but they can't. They're not legally responsible. Young children.
Misquote me. Okay. I'm saying you cannot create a right which affects my decision unless there is some duty. I'm not talking about some non-existent right of a snail darter.
Oh,
now, if the snail darter can enact the law, then it has a right. But before that, it does not.
But children can't enact laws, and some people can't do that.
That's
but
correct.
Can't they have rights?
That's correct. That's
they
why
are getting rights.
Attempting to protect children.
Yeah, but they can't participate in the legislative process to decide whether.
That's correct. They cannot.
Separately, we're going to have this, but
neither
can they still have rights.
But they can have advocacy groups.
They can have advocacy groups and argue like crazy. That's right.
So you got proxy voices that can speak on behalf of incumbents.
Sure. All three of these people.
Why can't proxy voices speak on behalf of animals?
He said they did. He said they were. Those were proxies that were talking after you.
Anybody can argue.
Is there something wrong with that?
No.
Well, it depends on their motives. The question is whether they said the plant has a right or I think the plant should have a right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the difference. If they want to say the plant has a right, they go, where do you get it from?
I think what the latter would mean, if I say the plant should have a right, I think that that's a roundabout way of saying that very good reasons can be given for asserting that the plant has a moral right, and when I say the plant should have a right, what I'm saying is that that moral right ought to be protected by law.
Your definition of moral was it is based upon a rule. Your own words. That rule does not spring up spontaneously. It comes as the reaction of persons who sit down and say, what is moral? When they decide that, then you've got a moral, after all, is the same thing as the statute of the federal legislative body, except the enforcement process is different.
We are enlightened to be immoral, amoral, and moral.
Can I also bring up the other? There are too many people in the world that 90% of them should maybe be getting off the earth. The hot zone is a true book that I just finished reading on my trip I was taking. Ebola, which is a cousin of the HIV, has come out of the rainforest because we have taken so much of the rainforest out of circulation by putting in farms, that it's going to come and kill a lot of people because it's coming back at us because you're not leaving it where it should be in the middle of the rainforest. And,
so
and
we
the virus doesn't care. The virus wants meat. And what is the most meat in the world? People.
So we were unenlightened in our pursuit of a humanistic
there's another read on that, and that is that it's been around since the beginning of time, and we just stumbled into it, and now there's enough transportation that it can affect the world. But until that happened, whatever ran into it died out, that was it. It never moved into humans.
But it can.
And humans aren't its good host.
No, monkeys are.
I dispute that people are the most meat on the earth. I think it's insects.
Yes.
I think so. The ant in biomass outweighs us all.
Let me. What time is it?
I don't know if the Ebola likes ants. We don't know that. It's 11:30.
Okay.
I guess we should, you know, call it quits.
I get to the point where I don't have any answer.
You have until 11:45.
I never had a group of 18 to 20 where I'll say this, oh, please, Dr. Peters, would you continue? Usually, you know, they start closing their binders and snapping all this kind of stuff, you know. But, yeah, all right. So I have a standard comeback and say, well, I see the class is about ready to dismiss me.
I don't know that we're about ready to dismiss you. I think we're just we're sitting here pressure cooking and spouting off.
Let me run by you a short and sweet argument, which I hope you find vexatious. From the other wing of the animal liberation debate, this is the wing represented by the man who's regarded as the founding father of animal lib, whose name is Peter Singer, who is a philosopher at Monash University in Australia. And in 1974, Pete Singer wrote an article in a prestigious philosophical journal, which is regarded as the manifesto of the animal lib movement, and the title of it was, and you, since we've been through our little conversation, you'll appreciate it. The title was, All Animals Are Equal. Now, human, non-human, I mean, that's inclusive. I mean, an arresting title, and he defended the equality of humans and animals. He's written whole books from his particular point of view on this. How about this for an argument? This is an argument designed to show you why eating meat is immoral. Now, pay really careful attention to every little move along the way and see whether you can spot some move that seems to be, oh, right there is where he got off the track. Because if you can't finger point at where he got derailed, it looks as though it's going to just sort of fly in your face that the end of this is that no more hamburgers or filet mignon. I mean, from now on, it's, you know, tomato juice and tofu or whatever.
Okay.
I thought that was good. Okay, premise one. Are omnivores. Now what that means is, as far as food sources, we're ambidextrous. I mean, that's part of our trick. I mean, we can eat grains and vegetables, we can eat meat, it's great, part of our survival quick. Now, it follows from the claim that we're omnivores, that humans do not need, italicized, underlined three times in red, we do not need meat to survive or to survive well. We don't need it. In fact, I point to all kinds of cultures that never touch meat. Entire vegetarian cultures. They don't seem to be worse for it, probably better. Okay? Now we need to account for why it is in this country we eat meat. And the most plausible answer is we eat meat is because we prefer the taste of meat to grains and vegetables. It's just a taste preference, really. We're kind of a chewy kind of culture, and, you know, a little watercress and tomato juice versus a filet mignon, it's a non-issue. Okay? Now, the next premise is that in order to provide us
table meat at the lowest possible cost, animals are undergo a process of intensive animal husbandry in this country, which causes pain to the animals. It really does. I mean, it's not just the slaughterhouse, but it's, you know, feedlot existence prior to the slaughterhouse and all this kind of stuff. He wrote a whole essay called Down on the Factory Farm, which describes how broiler hens are raised in hen houses and how veal calves are raised by Provini up in my state and so forth. It makes you cry, okay? I mean, if you have to give him the premise that, yes, animals endure pain as a result of intensive husbandry leading for the production of table meat. Now, will you consent to the following moral principle? It's always wrong to heap needless pain on humans. That's so boring, isn't it? Morally wrong to heap needless, pointless, gratuitous pain on humans. Of course. See that? Now, animals are relatively like humans insofar as they, like us, can experience pleasure and pain. If so. Now, if it's morally wrong to heap gratuitous pain on humans, for what reason? Well, because pain's bad? We don't like it? Then, since animals are relatively like humans, insofar as they're capable of experiencing pain, in other words, equals got to be treated equally, then it would be morally wrong to heap gratuitous, pointless pain on animals, right? I don't think I've tripped up here yet, have I? Okay?
Yes.
Okay, keep the moment. There's only two more moves in a row. If it's morally wrong to heap pointless, gratuitous pain on animals, then we have to come back to what we got to earlier in the argument. Namely, we already conceded that we don't need meat to survive or survive well. Yet we have an industry that's involved in the heaping of pain upon animals for a product that we don't need. Hence, we have an exercise in the infliction of needless pain, and that is why the modern agribusiness of animal husbandry is morally wrong. Now, where do we go astray, Ted?
In the inability to separate your notion of ethics from your notion of morals.
I don't really know what the difference is.
With ethics, and say that an ethic is based upon the capacity to love and not to cause harm, then I'm with you all the way. If, however, you take your original statement and say that an ethic is simply the process by which we make our determinations to do what is moral, and moral is defined as a rule which has been established someplace, then you don't have your morality to gauge, by which to gauge your ethical conduct.
So ethics for you would be the process of setting up a moral rulebook.
Yes.
The process. The moral rulebook is the yield of the ethical enterprise, yes. which is fundamentally reflected.
A very little piece of history here in our discussion this morning. If we would go back only a few centuries, is it wrong to destroy a human being? Is it wrong to break an arm or, you know, injure a body? That answer, only a few centuries would have been, well, if you had deprived the king of a useful archer or plowman or a good cowmonger or something, yes, it's wrong. But if you mean, is it wrong to destroy a person who's not useful to the king in any way, that would be silly. He's a drag on the king, and after all, the rights are all on the king. Now, we've managed to, by hard labor over the last few centuries, to get to the place where we say to each other, we believe, we have certain unalienable, not yet, but unalienable rights. That is to say, we are endowed by certain characteristics which we are incapable of giving away. And we've got enough of us persuaded that that's true, so we now have enacted a series of principles, morals, rules, whatever you want to call it, one form of law, rule or another. Mm-hmm. And now we gauge our ethical conduct by this rapid, recently developed system.
Well, you're really taking a big picture here. Ted, where did you think this argument specifically went down to?
I mean, I'm just the argument. I'm just told you to become a vegetarian.
When we started becoming agricultural, that if people have said that before we became agricultural, we had small little tribes, we hunted and we ate berries, and then when we started doing agriculture, we were able to have too many people, and that really started the whole overpopulation problem that we see today with our world. And you know, we're able to feed so many people, and we have so many people, and that started all the other problems that we see in the things that you talked about.
At the same time, it started some of the solutions that are going forward. And that's where, you know, what is the motive? So you go back to what is the motive behind each of these arguments.
Well, if we hadn't become agricultural to begin with, we wouldn't be seeing all the problems, because the animals would have been left alone. We wouldn't have done animal husbandry, which is really what causes the pain. We would have probably killed a few animals, but we wouldn't have killed as many as we're killing now with McDonald's and Burger King and all the rest. We would have eaten what we needed, and there would have been very few of us doing that.
But if pain becomes the weight on the other side of the balancing tool, what's pain?
So
that.
I
give you an ostensive definition. There's an experience. That's what I mean.
But that is life. That,
right.
That to me is
coming here was pain.
That to me.
This ends the session.